It's Wednesday, July 13, 2016, and this is KBIA's Views of the News. Our weekly roundtable on media behaviors comes to you from the Futures Lab studio at the Reynolds Journalism Institute. I'm Amy Simons, and here with me are my colleagues Brett Johnson and Ernest Perry. On our program this week, Gretchen Carlson's sexual harassment case against Roger Ailes. She claims she was fired from the cable news network after refusing to give in to his repeated advances, despite the fact ratings for her primetime talk show were steadily increasing. Now Fox has hired a lawyer and is circling the wagon around Ailes. And is there an attack on press freedoms here in Missouri? We'll talk about a St. Louis reporter who was jailed after asking questions about a police department's car registration practices. Given the arrests of reporters 2 years ago in Ferguson, changes to access at the state capitol, should we be worried? There's a lot more that hopefully we'll get to as well, but let's start with a long week here in the United States. Two police-involved shootings resulting in the deaths of black men, a black man vowing revenge, shooting 12 Dallas police officers, killing five of them. The Washington Post has been tracking the number of police-involved shootings and are finding that, as outrageous as it sounds to have two in 24 hours, it's not that unusual. What made the events of the last week somewhat different? There was a lot of video, and it was all right there in front of our eyes. Let's talk for a second about how the video has played out in these two cases in the last week.
Well, I think one of the ways it has played out is that across the country, people are seeing images of police-involved shootings in a upfront, close, and almost personal way. I mean, especially the Facebook posting in the Philando shooting, Castillo shooting in Minnesota, in which, you know, his fiance is not just taping it. She's streaming it live. She's giving you an annotated sort of play by play on what happened and what was happening. And I think that going out the way it did really sort of wake people up to, whoa, wait a minute, we do have some issues here. And then, you know, the Baton Rouge shooting, where the two police officers jump the man who someone had called in 911. We found out later it was a homeless man who was upset at him because of a dispute that he had with the gentleman, and the police officers show up and you begin and you see that close up. Well, I mean, I think what's happening is that the technology is allowing people to see these incidents up close and personal.
I think that's true. This isn't the first time, though, that we've seen deaths on air or that have been filmed. The Fruitvale Station shooting with Oscar Grant being one of the first. Who's the man in Charleston who was shot?
Yes,
he was. You know, that was
running away from police.
That was. I think the video, especially the very up close and personal, and the fact that she's there narrating it with the wherewithal almost of a journalist. I'm surprised she wasn't more hysterical. She was very kind of eerily with it and calm with what she was, you know, as her partner was dying.
With her four-year-old child in the back.
But I think the videos are part of it. I think the other part is hopefully we're reaching a point where we're just saying enough is enough.
I mean, one of the things that sort of jumped out at me on this was, you know, you have a lot of people saying, well, you know, now we're at a pivot point. These videos are showing up, and now the country as a whole is being exposed to what African Americans have been experiencing for a while, and this is something new. Well, in a way, it's not really that new. Back in the 1950s, and in particularly in the 1960s, with the advent of television and the advent of video and the advent of the cameras being there in a lot of the nonviolent protests that turned violent when you had fire hoses, the Children's March in Birmingham, Selma, you go back. I mean, that the newness of the technology sort of galvanized and woke a lot of people up about the injustices that were going on in society. And I think we're at that moment here where you have technology playing a role in opening up what some people thought was, you know, just an isolated incident, and showing, well, wait a minute, you know, this is happening a lot more than they may have been aware of.
And I think also the fact that it's live, I can think back to to 9/11, those people who saw live the second plane going into the tower, I think was very shocking compared to seeing footage. I mean, it's still shocking to see, but compared to footage of it later, the fact that that Diamond Reynolds filmed the aftermath of Philando Castile's shooting live, I think that there, qualitatively, there's something there that adds something that is much more shocking and it gets a much more emotional response.
So one of the things as we talk about the live nature of that video, we talk about how mobile devices really make it possible through citizen journalism that really everybody now has the capability to go live, something that isn't unique to television stations anymore. And the three of us have talked a lot over the course of the last month or so about Facebook and its role. And if it's simply a platform, if it is part of the news media, after what's happened since last week, is it really up for debate anymore?
I don't think it's up for debate. I mean, we've talked about this for several years. We've talked about the fact that mainstream news organizations and even bloggers and others have been using Facebook. They've been using Twitter. They've used Google. They've used all sorts of distribution, social media distribution models to get their information out there. Now what you're seeing is that individuals have figured out with the use of apps and that sort of thing, and through Facebook and through others, ways to distribute information. And usually, you know, it's someone playing a video of a birthday party or the cat videos we talk about all the time. Now you're talking about actual incidents that involve real life and death and conflict. And you're starting to, and people are looking at that and saying, hey, whenever we see someone getting pulled over by police, we're going to stop and we're going to videotape it because something may happen. Or whenever we see conflict involving two individuals, for whatever reason, we're gonna stop, we're gonna videotape that on our cell phones, and we're gonna send it out through Facebook or through Twitter or through Periscope. You know, you go on and on and on. And that to me is a huge difference.
So there's a piece on our Links blog from Pointer that is meant to challenge journalists to think about the value of their live streams and what they're putting out there. Let me put some of those considerations on the table here. There are 10 of them in the piece, but some of the ones that stuck out to me in questioning whether or not you should go live before you do. One of them, what is the reason beyond competitive factors for going live? Are you providing meaningful contextual coverage or simply speculating while trying to fill time? Does it make sense editorially to give someone a live, unfiltered platform to voice their grievances? And then here's a biggie. Are you prepared for the short-term or long-term consequences if the worst outcomes play out in your live stream? These valid considerations, and how and where do they go from just being considerations for journalists and for the general public and how they use these tools too?
Well, you know, this, I think the biggest thing to lament here is how quickly this came upon. We hadn't even figured out how to deal with pre-recorded user-generated content. So, for example, the video of Neda from 2009 in Iran being shot, that was put on social media. Then the question was, okay, well, it's out there on YouTube. What are the ethics behind grabbing that, either linking to it or putting it on there? Would it be shocking? You know, sure, it's going to drive traffic, but you know, what are the ethics there? You know, here we are 7 years later, we still haven't figured out those ethics. And now all of a sudden we have this new dilemma. I think before we get to the journalism side of it, when it comes to Facebook, we've talked the last couple of weeks about Facebook being this arbiter of content, of deciding what the norms are in terms of our news diet, in terms of what's allowable public discourse on their platforms. Now, out of this drive for competing with Twitter, who came out with Periscope before Facebook came out with their live feature, now we have this new issue of, when is something going to be allowable and when is it not? So before even we as journalists can give someone a live platform, Facebook has to come up with their own norms of when something is going to be allowed or not. And they're not doing it in a very transparent way. So I think whatever discussion we get in as journalists as to when we should be able to use or when we should use this kind of live content, hopefully we can, you know, provide some guidance to Facebook.
Well, I mean, to me, I think the industry is going to have to decide. And right now, their decision right now is competition. when you start going down that list. Whatever I need to do, and I mean Facebook, I mean Twitter, whatever I need to do in order to be ahead, one step ahead of my competition, I'm going to do. So if I need to develop Periscope where people can put up their own live videos, and that's going to give me a leg up on my competition, then I'm going to do that without thinking about the consequences of what happens when someone does what we saw last week. Okay. Now, all of a sudden, you go like, whoa, wait a minute. I didn't see that coming. So now you're going to start trying to set parameters about when someone can go live. Are you going to put a delay on that?
But here's my question with that. How can you use the defense or the rationale of I didn't see that coming? Haven't we been in this situation with live television and high-speed chases? It's something that's on TV in Los Angeles every single day where a station will put their chopper up, and you never know how that high-speed chase is going to end up.
Well, to me, it goes back, like I said, I mean, you're putting competition and you're putting trying to get one step ahead of your competition, ahead of thinking about the ethical decisions that underlie that.
Okay.
And that, to me, is part of the problem. And we don't seem to be thinking that rationally until something forces us to. And now Facebook is at that moment. Now they're forced to think about, okay, how do we allow our users to do this? If they can't manage it themselves, then we're going to manage it for it. Because ultimately, what could happen is that somebody sues Facebook, and you have a jury that agrees with the plaintiff, and Facebook goes the way of Gawker.
Mm-hmm. Well, so there's something else about this whole thing, and maybe video played a really big part in it. But for what feels like the first time, the conservative media is seeing a problem here too. And again, I point folks to our links blog. I've put a couple of pieces up there from Red State and from the Daily Caller. Question I guess I have to both of you is, the conservative media is now seeing there's a problem here now. Why now? Why not after Ferguson? Why not after Sandra Bland? Why not after any of these other dozens of cases of black and brown men and women who've died at the hands of police?
It's a combination of factors. I think one, we talked about the liveness of the video being maybe qualitatively more shocking than videos in the past. The fact that maybe now that we're seeing this conflict in the Republican Party with Donald Trump as the presumptive nominee, and the nationalist and racist rhetoric that if not him directly, but his followers just tend to espouse, some of these old Republican values of accountability and of formal equality are getting dusted off among more moderate Republicans, more establishment Republicans. And I think this is now this issue of black men being unjustifiably killed in this fashion hits that nerve. It hits that nerve of what is, let's go back and realize this, what formal equality really is, and apply it to these situations. So I think those are a couple factors that I see.
You know, I also think that what's happening is that, you know, the fact that people are able to connect with these videos in a personal way, they're really starting to think about, what kind of a country are we? What's happening here? I mean, we've talked around the margins. And we've done this on the show, mm-hmm. talked around the margins of what is right and what is wrong, and without actually talking about the issue, which is, there, number one, gun rights is an issue. Number two is the unjustness of our criminal justice system when it comes to black and brown people. What is the role of law enforcement in our society? And I think it's not just the conservative movement, but I also think the progressive movement is also dealing with those same things when we talk about inequality. I mean, yes, we're focusing in on the conservative movement, but I think the progressive movement, they're struggling with certain things as well, because there's a divide there when it comes to when you start talking about inequality and those who support Bernie Sanders and those who support Hillary Clinton. And I think the problem becomes, and we talked about this over and over, is that we and I would say we in the media aren't mm-hmm. providing the context that's necessary to have these kinds of discussions. And I go back to the president's eulogy yesterday during the funeral, during the memorial service for the five officers, when he was providing a lot of context to where we are now. And the media tended to focus on the statements that he made about the police and the statements he made about the protesters, and not about how he contextualized both of those segments.
So then let me ask you this, because this is kind of the big loaded question. Looking at what we have seen on TV, online, in the newspapers over the course of the last week, did the media help the situation or hurt it?
I think in many ways they hurt it. And I think they hurt it because we're in the political season and everything starts to revolve around politics. And I give you a perfect example. The president's press conference in Warsaw, he sort of laid everything out. The first question, the first reporter who got up to speak to him, I think was an AP reporter. Her question revolved around asking the president, what did he think the shooter was in the shooter's mind? Was it a hate crime? What do you think about the criticism you're receiving about your stance on gun control? Is this Americans retreating to their tribes and not really coming out to talk about it? And I'm listening to the question. And I'm saying, number one, how's the president going to know what the shooter was in somebody's mind? Yeah. Is this a hate crime or domestic terrorism? And the criticism, I mean, it's almost like you're playing down the political playbook without thinking about what does this mean for the country as a whole.
Almost your like question, working away down a checklist opposed to
your questions don't really go to the heart of what the issue is, because you're concerned about how this looks politically as a reporter. And so yes, I'm sorry, but that you're not helping the situation when you ask those questions.
Nor are they helping when it comes to some of the shock value that they're trying to reap from these events. So the cover of the New York Post of this is a civil war, apparently, you know, that gets to the same issues we were talking about just a few minutes ago with going live and the ethics of what you have to, you know, of getting the most clicks or you're putting your bottom line before any kind of principles. You know, if there's any benefit to that, it's the denunciation of it. It's you know, you have to have those kind of fringe media groups putting that out there for hopefully the rest of us to denounce it and move forward. But a lot of it
isn't then being denounced. And I think about how it then filters in down to social media and onto the person to person level.
Right.
Ernest, I have to tell you, I call it the Dr. Perry mantra that I use in my classes and how you teach students. It's not about you.
Yeah.
Well, on some level this weekend, I kind of had to make it about me because I felt like a ping pong ball going back and forth where I had to shut off the TV. I had to go off of social media for the weekend. I read two books this weekend about North Korea because it somehow seemed easier to immerse myself in North Korea than to consume a lot of what it is that you're talking about.
No, and I think a lot of people probably did that. It was just like, wait a minute, this is just too much because, you know, we aren't providing, I'll say we in the media are not providing enough context, enough modern historical context and the larger scope about what it means to have these kinds of struggles and work through them in a way that's going to help people. We fall into the trap of finding which camps are willing to talk, and we allow them to control the narrative. And we sort of try to act as a moderator, but we're not really moderating anything because no one's really learning anything.
Right.
It's just back and forth.
All you're really doing is playing traffic cop, for lack of a better term, traffic cop between the screaming talking heads,
exactly.
trying to get one of them to stop talking over the other. Yeah,
right. And generating apathy, I think, aside from the misinformation that comes out of framing this in terms of a conflict.
Mm-hmm.
I was the same as you this weekend, Amy. I normally I'm in front of the news 24/7, and not because I didn't want to learn more about any of the victims this weekend. I was just, I had enough, I think, of the way this was framed, of the lack of context, and I would bet a lot of people felt that same kind of apathy, and that's a tragedy.
Well, there are some other things we can be talking about this week too, so let's go ahead and hit some of those before we run out of time. One day late last week, I saw a headline on the Columbia Journalism Review's website that caught my eye. It read, "A reporter's arrest is just the latest reason to worry about press freedom in Missouri." it showed, while there are also reports of reporter, this is all going on at the same time that we're hearing about reports of reporters getting into the thick of things in Dallas and Baton Rouge and ending up in police custody there. So at first I glanced over it, but then realized it wasn't about that at all. It was about another case, one that I actually had read about 10 days ago and hadn't given much thought to at all. But the headline made me stop. What sparked Duron Lee's column was the arrest of KTVI reporter Chris Hayes. Hayes is an investigative reporter for the Fox station in St. Louis, and he stumbled upon a pretty good story. The Kinloch, Missouri Police Department had failed to register or insure its vehicles. His first story uncovering this ran on June 29th. The next day, he went to a public meeting in Kinloch where a police captain stopped him at the door and told him he couldn't enter the public meeting if he wanted to bring in his camera. Hayes argued he had a right to be there and to bring his camera inside, and he was promptly handcuffed and arrested. He reported on his own arrest for Fox 2, saying he was issued a summons and will face a judge in September on charges of disorderly conduct and failure to comply. There probably was some grandstanding, some acting for the camera in his reports, because scenes like that, let's be honest, they make some pretty good video. But at the same time, there's some reason for concern when a cop is keeping you out of a public meeting.
When I read the story, here's what I think about. Okay. I think that the police department was upset about the previous reports that he had done. The captain saw an opportunity to go after him, and he took it. I'd be shocked if this made it into a courtroom. I think that he was sending the reporter a message saying, if you run something like that, you better be ready for us to come after you. It sets a bad precedent. And what I'm hoping is that other law enforcement and the criminal justice system, a judge, a prosecutor, will get to this captain and say, wait a minute, you know, you overstepped your bounds. You can't do this. It's a public meeting. Reporter's been allowed to come in the past. He was allowed to come in here.
Yeah.
Regardless of what he or she may have done previously, you don't have the authority to do that.
So, Brett, let me ask you this. The Columbia Journalism Review article lists pretty much in a stack a series of different issues in the past 5 years or so as it relates to press freedoms here in the state of Missouri, including what went on in Ferguson 2 years ago with the arrest of reporters there, the ag gag law that limits how we're able to report on certain agricultural issues, problems that reporters have had reporting on the death penalty and how that's carried out down in Potosi, and then bringing into view what happened here on campus last November. But I have to ask you, especially because you're relatively new to the state, is it any worse here than it is anywhere else?
Oh, I think we're in the middle of a perfect storm here in Missouri, where we've had all these issues. When it comes to press freedom, and when it comes to open meeting laws, open records laws, anything with access to the press, which are already, we receive much lower protection as journalists because a lot of those are defined by statutes rather than any kind of First Amendment access. So we're already kind of starting at a lower, across the country at a lower level. But there's what, you know, there's what the law says, and there's the gray area that we all live in society. So, you know, if sure the state sunshine law says, yes, you should be able to access any public meeting. You should be able to record it. And then you get to the municipality and they can put up a sign that says you must ask permission. No one then challenges it, right? No one, you know, and even Chris Hayes himself said, oh yeah, I in the past I would always go up and ask just out of a courtesy, right? And it was almost like the courtesy was being codified with that sign. And then it became this arbitrary issue, this issue of arbitrary enforcement. So I guess those are the points. We're starting at kind of this already at a low level when it comes to rights of access and news gathering, arbitrary enforcement, lack of challenging these policies. And then, you know, the list that the Columbia Journalism Review article pointed out, all of those are problems, but each one is very different. And as we're talking about context, each one has its own distinct set of issues and context. I agree with the criticism, Darren Lee's criticism in the Columbia Journalism Review, that it's unfortunate how politicized the First Amendment and press freedoms or any kind of freedom of expression, using the term freedom of expression, has become, where politicians will wrap themselves in the Constitution when it is beneficial to them, but will selectively disregard it when it's not.
Okay, there's also a biggie that's circulating over at Fox News Channel, where former host Gretchen Carlson has filed suit against network boss Roger Ailes, accusing him of making sexual advances toward her and retaliating against her when she didn't reciprocate that interest. Is this the type of thing that you think we're ever going to see in a courtroom? Ailes is pushing for arbitration on this one.
This is going to be interesting. If she wants to take this all the way, if she's fighting for the rights of all the women at Fox News and all the women in situations like this, you'll see it in a courtroom. Otherwise, it's probably going to go to arbitration. They'll probably mediate it out. She'll get a settlement. And we won't hear anything about it until somebody writes a book.
God knows how many
years later. But that's that, to me, that's what's going to happen here. My sense is that she's going to try to fight this all the way to court because I think she wants to make a statement. It's not with her. It's not about the money. It's the way in which women in the business are being treated today. And they thought that they had fought this battle. They thought that this was something that they didn't have to deal with. And now here we are again.
But it's still something there. And hasn't really gone anywhere. What are we seeing from what's going on at Fox and people on the inside there in terms of levels of support that they're showing for Roger Ailes?
Well, what it looks like is, I was reading somewhere today that typically the Murdochs wouldn't any kind of internal issue, they just kind of sweep under the rug. But they've actually hired an outside counsel to come in and do an independent investigation. So that's, I think, what I've been seeing is a sign that there could be a shakeup. There's also the kind of political take that that Murdoch's sons want Ailes out and want to have control over the network themselves.
They don't have the same relationship with him that their father does.
So that could be part of it as well. That could bode well for or not. If they get him out before this ever goes to court, that might be detrimental for Gretchen to not be able to take this all the way to court and make a point.
Okay, well, the clock on the wall tells me we're pretty much out of time for this week. I'd like to thank you for spending the last half hour with us. You can read more about the topics we talked about today, and that's on our links blog. It's under the programs tab at kbia.org. Like us on Facebook or follow us on Twitter. Our handle there is @viewsonkbia. Want to watch or listen to our program again or find it in some new ways? We're available online at kbia.org, on YouTube, and everywhere you find your favorite podcasts, including the NPR One app. These are all great ways to watch and listen to the program again, leave us comments or questions, see previews of what we'll be talking about next week, and more. Our thanks to Pat Akers for handling the audio today. We're going to be off for a few weeks, but we'll be back with you again in early August for another edition of Views of the News.